Luck on Sunday, brought to you by Whirlpool. Bet with the world.
Welcome to the Luck on Sunday podcast, a weekly audio digest of all the best bits of Luck on Sunday, free to air every Sunday from 9 o'clock, that brings you the best guests and insight from around the racing world. First, a man who has got real hopes of riding not one, but a couple of Cheltenham Festival winners this year, off the back of a very productive couple of years since he was last in the Luck on Sunday studio. He has the plum ride on Crambo in the Stayers Hurdle, and that's not all. He is, of course, Johnny Burke. Johnny, good morning.
Morning, Nick.
I can't believe 2 years has elapsed since you were last here, but they've been two pretty productive years, haven't they? How do you feel that things are going?
Very well, yeah. As you said, they've been productive on a steadily upward curve, I suppose. Building some nice contacts too, so yeah, it's good.
Do I get the feeling that you feel it's too steady for your liking?
At times, yeah, but I was just looking this morning, it's 10 years since I had the Alan Potts job, so it doesn't happen today or tomorrow. So it does take time, but you just have to be patient. People think I'm well into my 30s, but I'm only 28, so I suppose I've got plenty of time yet.
And that, of course, is the risk that comes with being a child prodigy, isn't it? When you're thrust into the limelight when you're 17, 18 and everyone's expecting you to be riding Grade 1 winners every other weekend.
I suppose, yeah. And when I was that age riding those horses, I didn't really know what a bad day was. You know, it was just everything was great. And I was saying to someone yesterday, I wouldn't have thought about form or other horses in the race. I was just riding these wonderful horses like Size and John, Size in Europe. And it was just a complete dream. Whereas you get a bit older, you more experience and you start looking into things more and form, and you're just going out in races and you know more. So there's that element too. I was, I suppose, carefree when I was riding for Alan Potts and that. But there's been a few like injuries along the way as well, which probably didn't help. And moving to England was different as well. The first year took me a long time to settle, and once it did click, I love it here now. And like, as I said, building up contacts steadily away, so it's good.
You did stick at it though, and you could easily have said, no, this isn't for me, I'm going back. And you've been involved in several yards along the way, Charlie Longston and Tom George, and now with Harry Fry, riding a little bit, as we were saying, for Fergal O'Brien and others. Was there ever a temptation to say, do you know, it's not quite working out here, I'm going home?
Not particularly. I suppose one could say, why can't I keep a job down? Because I've had plenty, I suppose. But they've just been steadily progression, really. Things happen at the right time over here for me in terms of, like, Charlie gave me the probably in that I needed, because I was coming on the back of losing the job with Anne Allen Potts and I was injured for the best part of a year.
So you could have been completely forgotten about. You could have just disappeared without a trace.
I was 21. I remember getting the call. I was at the Derby sale with Dad. I was 21 and Charlie rang me, said, oh, do you want to move things? I went over and looked at him and met him, whatever. But I was 21, and I was like, if I go till I'm 25, I always had the comfort blanket of moving back home. So if I give it till I'm 24 or 5, see how we go. So I moved, and I went to Charlie. Probably didn't take off as I initially thought it would, for whatever reason. Just getting to know the tracks in England. The lifestyle was different, like you're racing every single day and you're travelling. So Ben Tellemer won at the back end of the season in Aintree, and that was the turning point then. Started right for Tom George. Leighton Aspel retired, so riding for Oliver Sherwood. Noel Feely retired at the right time for me. That brought along Somerville Boy and Black Op for Roger Brookhouse. So each year I probably had a Saturday horse to kind of keep me going. And with Noel retiring as well, that opened up Harry Fry. Sean Bone was stable jockey first to Harry, and just steadily progression. Again, it went from Tom is now focusing on France, still got plenty of horses here. Oliver retired, and I was able to give my full commitment to Harry then.
So there you are. So you've been around, but I always imagine that you're quite an affable guy to deal with. Having lots of jobs might suggest to people different, but it really is just a force of circumstance.
Yeah, like, there's been no falling outs along.
I've never heard anyone say that Berkey's absolutely impossible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, that's the thing. Although I've had plenty stints, I've not fallen out with anyone. Like, I still ride for Charlie, and he was the first man to bring me to England. So it's just been circumstances, really, as you said. But, like, I'm probably at the position now where I was able to fall in for a ride on the likes of Crambo and stuff like that. But there's been great horses along the way, the likes of Not So Sleepy. He came through Hen Knight along the time, Glenn Forza and Mr. Whittaker. So there's just been the right things happen at the right time. It's been good, yeah.
Given that you've mentioned him, we ought to start on that before we move on to the horses that you are going to ride at the Cheltenham Festival. The way that the cards have fallen mean you're not going to be riding your old friend Not So Sleepy, and Sean Bowen gets on after you had to get off him in the rescheduled Fighting Fifth at Sandown. Do you just have to shrug your shoulders and say that's the way the cookie crumbles?
Pretty much. It wasn't really a decision for me in Sandown. I couldn't get off Love Envoy, really. Again, with circumstances, with my connection to Harry Fry, and then with the Noel Feely and Dave Cross. So, like, it wasn't really a decision to make. Could I see him going and winning the way he did? No. Could I see him win the Champion Hurdle? Probably not. But you just wouldn't know what I'm like. I probably got him at a good time as well. Like, he's been great for me. Like, he dead heat in a Fighting Fifth with Epitant, won the big hurdle at Ascot. So he's been good to me, and, like, it'd be bittersweet, but like, the owners are brilliant people, and you is a great man. So if he did go and win, you know, brilliant. But
it's quite a story, isn't it?
It is.
12 years old.
At that age, to still be fighting, like, at that level as well. He's been racing since he was two, like, but he only ended up jumping by accident, because I think he got very free, I think, in Ewes, and they sent him over to Hens just to try jumping or try something different. And we started schooling him, and he wasn't easy, but we got there in the end, and he's been great. But, like, even since he started jumping, he's been mixing it on the flat as well. He was second or third on the flat in Newmarket as well last year, I think.
So. Yeah, he won at Newbury, didn't he?
He won at Newbury, yeah.
Very impressively, yeah.
So, like, yeah. But, Love Envoy probably didn't perform in the Fighting Fifth either, and it was just one of those days. But
are you getting her back, do you think, Love Envoy?
Yeah, like, the last day was back to... She raced with more enthusiasm, raced the way she, like... She went with the handbrake on in Sandown. She had a little injury last year, and she was just about ready to start. She wasn't at her best, and she was probably just telling us that as well. So she's gone quite clever. She schooled her the morning, she was good. So it's all system go. I think it's going to be her final run. So
Final run ever?
I think so. So the lad said the other day she might end up in the entry sale.
Really?
As a broodmare, maybe.
Broodmare prospect. Is that a measure, do you think, of the fact that she's laid it all out for you and that's all she's got?
I think so. Like, you have to remember when she was a novice, she was a very hard mare, well, not hard mare to ride, but she was very free and free going. So she, every day she ran, she gave 110%. So those horses can only stay going for a certain number of seasons. So I think the time is right. And, like, she ran a great race last year, nearly spoiled the party. But yeah, if she can go in the same form this year, she'll be thereabouts. Whether she can turn the tables with Lossie Mount is probably... Probably a tall ask, but
But she will be maybe arguably better suited by the trip than will Lossie Mount.
100%, yeah, 100%. Like, that's the only doubt about Lossie Mount, would she stay? But, like, if the top of the hill wasn't there and she was able to gallop into Cheltenham Town the other day, I'd say she probably would have. So I'd say Lossie Mount will stay. But the trip will suit Love Envoy more, and it might just bring us a little bit closer. Mm.
Harry Fry is a trainer that you've developed this terrific rapport with. I couldn't believe how few horses he actually trains now relative to the results that he's getting.
Yeah, I don't know why, is his circumstances or what, but he turns up on the Saturdays, and when he hits that, when he does say go about one, like, and sets one up for a day, they're never far away. Like, he's going to Cheltenham with six or seven runners, you know.
Well, this is a quarter or a fifth of his yard going to Cheltenham. And I rang in the other day and just had a look down the entries and I thought, well, there's quite a lot to talk about here.
Yeah, yeah.
And none of them was a complete no-hoper either. They all had bits and pieces of chances. Yet there's stables with three, literally three times the amount of horses who cannot muster a runner at the festival.
Yeah, it is funny. He's a man that deserves to have more horses based on his results. Great man to work with.
So you've worked now for a lot of trainers. We've established this. So give me Harry Fry in a word.
Dedicated. He puts a lot into it. Like him and Kira thinks a lot about it. His horses probably don't run that much throughout the season. I think Sean Bone alluded to that in an interview earlier in the year. But
So if you're in need of an engine to fire your Jockeys Championship bid, that's probably not the right place.
Potentially, yeah. But like again, as I said, on the Saturdays and the big races, he's there. Mm. And like each Saturday this year, like Boot Hill turned up, Gidley Park, all them As I say, going to Cheltenham, there's six or seven horses there, and there's none of them going as a social runner, as you kind of say, you know.
So very shortly on the show this morning, I'll be joined by Ben Pauling. What a selection of horses he's got for the Cheltenham Festival, and he was amongst the winners at Kelso yesterday. Lee Mottershead will be along as well. We'll be reviewing and reflecting on all the events in Parliament over the last week, which included that debate last Monday and some very significant contributions in it and some very significant comment coming out of it. First, however, before we welcome Ben and Lee to the show, I want to share with you a story that I touched upon on my podcast on Friday and which has had some very significant momentum over the course of the weekend. Lucy Horan is 28 and she is a bloodstock insurance executive at Wetherby's Hamilton. She's also ridden out for Charlie Fellows for a number of years and came second in the 2022 edition of the Macmillan race at York, where she raised significant funds for cancer charities. As I said on Friday, now she is in need of your help because she needs to go to Germany for her own treatment, and she picked up the story with me.
So on the 31st of January this year, I was unfortunately diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer, which, as you can imagine, as a 28-year-old young lady, fit, healthy, never had any health issues. There was nothing wrong with me. I just noticed a small lump in the upper right quadrant of my left breast, and had it biopsied and was diagnosed with breast cancer, which obviously, as you can imagine, came as quite a shock.
And this is something that you immediately had seen as soon as you noticed as well. So it was not as though there was no gap. You hadn't buried your head in the sand or anything like that.
Not at all, no. I'm quite a conscious person of my body, and as soon as I noticed it, I was like, oh, that's a bit strange. I just didn't think too much of it because obviously, you know, you can get a lot of benign things in your body like that. But for a woman, it was unusual. And so I got straight on it, and the NHS were fantastic in sort of getting me in quickly, getting a biopsy. But it was only about a month from when I first noticed it on Christmas Eve to when I was first diagnosed I got the results of that. So they move really quickly. But it was quite unbelievable, really. And I still can't really believe it, but we are where we are.
So what have you been told, Lucy, in terms of the treatment, the prognosis, and what needs to be done now?
So prognosis is an interesting thing. So I've basically been diagnosed with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. So that means that it's left its primary its primary location. So stage 3 means it's gone from the breast into the lymph nodes in under your armpit, and stage 4 means it's travelled out of those lymph nodes and into other areas of the body, which is unfortunately what's happened to me. With the type of cancer that I've got, especially in young people, it tends to be quite aggressive. So which means it grows quite quickly. So it's not unusual for it to have sort of all happen quite quickly. So they don't think I've had that lump for years and not noticed it, but it had unfortunately left my lymph nodes already, and travelled up into the lymph nodes in my neck and into some of my bones. I say some of my bones, quite a lot of my bones, but that's actually not unusual in when it sort of gets to that level around your body. There was some concern over my liver, but there I had an MRI scan and the results of that are negative, so it's not in my liver, which is great news. So it was, but it's still quite extensively all over my body. So the treatment options I had been offered is basically chemotherapy, which in terms of the type of cancer that I have, it's hormone responsive. So it's treatable with a type of chemotherapy that basically shuts down all those hormones to kill the cancer. Now, chemotherapy doesn't actually kill the stem cell of the cancer, so it can kill it to a point and keep it under control. But because it's left the primary part of my breast and it's become secondary breast cancer, they say it's incurable and it's the treatment is palliative. Now, palliative was quite a scary word to me because I'm thinking, oh God, you know, palliative means, you know, sort of how long have you got kind of thing. And I was very much sort of like, I don't want to know. Don't give me years. Don't give me days because I'm going to be the odd one out here. I'm not going to fit in with the statistics because the internet's a scary place when you start looking at statistics for these kind of things. And actually, as I sort of did a bit more research, I found that there are lots of people that live with metastatic breast cancer and just keep it under control effectively with the chemotherapy, with the hormone injections to suppress the hormones that mean that the cancer is active in your body effectively. And the only glitch with being on treatment for the rest of my life means that I am unable to have children, which was obviously completely devastating to hear at the time. And it's still, you know, pretty heartbreaking for me, but we're doing things before I start chemotherapy.
Yeah.
The egg harvesting.
You've actually just finished that before talking to me this morning.
Yes, I'm in my fertility clinic waiting to have my eggs harvested, which has been done on super speed by an amazing doctor in London. So yeah, that's about to happen. So I have the chance to have biological children. It's just at the moment, the way science is, it wouldn't be possible for me to carry a child myself. So I could have a biological child. It's sort of the start of IVF, the IVF process, effectively. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing that over the last 2 weeks, along with having some teeth out and all of the other things that have been going on, talking to the clinic in Germany. And yeah, so it's a lot's been going on.
So we need to get you to Germany because cancer treatment in Germany is that little more advanced. It's more technologically open-minded, shall we say, and
it's less the protocols in the UK. There's sort of a medical standard that they have to meet, and it's quite high. But Germany are more innovative in the way that they are treating cancer. And yeah, it was Johnny Hassett that put me in touch with the clinic in Germany that he dealt with, and. Yeah, so I've been in touch with them and they can offer me vaccine therapy in conjunction with the chemotherapy, the hormone injections, to basically, I don't know how much you know about vaccine therapy. It's quite interesting. I've learnt lots in the last couple of days. Cancer at the moment, my body doesn't recognise the cancer cells as foreign. So vaccine therapy, effectively, they take blood from you when the cancer is at the highest point in your body. So that's effectively now, because I haven't had any treatment. They take blood from you and they pull the cancer cells out of your blood, because each cancer is, although it's breast cancer or liver cancer or brain cancer or blood cancer, each cancer is actually unique to you personally. So because the cancer contains my DNA. So when they draw these cancer cells out of my blood, they effectively are able to create a personalized vaccine. So when they inject the vaccine, once they've created it from those cancer cells, it means that it will teach my body to recognize those cancer cells as foreign. so that my own immune system can fight those cells. So it's sort of the holy grail of cancer treatment is to kill those stem cells. And hopefully the vaccine therapy, if it works, it starts the process of, you know, killing my own body, killing those cells, so rather than being on continuous treatment, if you know what I mean. So it's very innovative, and it's very expensive, but it would give me a chance of effectively a cure, because I honestly don't believe being told that it's, I don't believe that it's not incurable. I think, yeah, these things are, you know, these things are remarkable, and medicine's amazing, and it's going to give me the best chance possible if I can do it effectively.
Well, you have our support, of course, and we are hoping that we can get you to the target by Tuesday. £25,000 by Tuesday is what we want. I can only commend your amazing resilience and wish you all the very best. Lucy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you.
Well, the heartening news that I can pass on after that interview that I conducted with Lucy on Friday, and we're now only on Sunday, is that there have been over 460 individual donations from the racing and bloodstock communities. And the target was 25,000. Well, that was exceeded within about 2 hours. And it's now up to over 60,000, this fund. Lucy has said that any surplus funds will go either to racing charities or will be set aside for people in similar situations in the sport who require this sort of treatment. So please don't think that our job is done. GoFundMe.com/F/ Lucy Horan needs your help. And we just keep our fingers firmly crossed that the pioneering treatment in Germany has the effect that we all desire, and we all wish Lucy well. Welcome back. You're watching Luck on Sunday. And before we continue, I need to give you today's Constitution Hill update, which is that there's no further news. I did ring Nicky Henderson before we started the show, and I said, look, is there anything likely to happen during the course of this morning or this afternoon that is going to progress the story from where we were yesterday? And he said, no, the key blood test results will come back tomorrow, and they probably won't come back until tomorrow afternoon. Just a reminder that yesterday he said that there would need to be I think he used the word miraculous turnaround in terms of the composition of that blood result in order for them to progress towards champion hurdlers. We welcome in Lee Mottisett, senior writer of the Racing Post, and Ben Pauling, trainer in form. Ben Pauling, my word, this is going well.
It's been, it's been another good year, but particularly good, I suppose, since Christmas time, when they seem to have hit a rich vein of form. Let's hope it can continue for the remainder of the season.
He's loaded with talent. How are you feeling with now just 10 days or so till the Cheltenham Festival?
Exhausted, really.
Already?
Yeah, and what with affordability checks, Westminster, up and down with interviews, I'll be going to Cheltenham for a rest, I think, at the moment. But no, it's good to be busy, and there's lots of interesting things to be writing about at the moment. Not all good, sadly, but lots of interesting things.
I'd imagine one of the most heartwarming things you've written about over the years was the success of Coney Gree in the Cheltenham Gold Cup as a novice back in 2015. We lost his trainer, Mark Bradstock, the day before yesterday, died at the age of 66. Clearly a very popular figure and a trainer with a little hint of, I don't know, je ne sais quoi, that enabled him and his wife, Sarah, to scale the heights that others can only dream of, really. He'd be much missed.
He will, as the reaction has made absolutely clear, Nick. I think everyone in sport, not just horse racing, but any sport, likes to see people who aren't generally associated with winning the massive events, winning mass events. They like to see Leicester City win the Premier League, that sort of thing. And when the Bradstocks won the Gold Cup with Coney Gree, we had an example of that. There was enormous support for them, genuine delight that they had won the Gold Cup. And I think as well, there was a realisation and an understanding that they absolutely hadn't fluked it. You know, they had got a novice chaser who possibly wasn't the easiest horse in the world to train. They trained him brilliantly, and they had been so brave in deciding to go for the Gold Cup in his novice season, they were proved absolutely right. And although Mark Bradstock has gone far too soon, he leaves a rich legacy.
Yes. Mark Bradstock is somebody you will have known quite well, Ben. He was always, always entertaining to talk to. He always had a different take on whatever you asked him about.
Yeah, he was. He was. Entertaining is a great way of summing him and Sarah and the family up. They're just good, fun people. They don't take themselves too seriously. And they were very, very able, as Lee's just, you know, stopped on. They were incredibly good at training a horse that needed a little bit of TLC and maybe something a little bit different. I was still at Seven Barrows when Coney Gree was winning Gold Cups, I think. In fact, I know. And I was great mates. I'm great mates with Nico. And I got sort of caught up in the whole thing, and I became a big Coney Gree believer. And I remember tipping it at everything I possibly could in the lead-up to Cheltenham, and people thought we were all nuts. But I was so enthralled in what could be and how special it was. And I still don't think the horse or Nico got credit for that result. You know, he made all on a novice in a Gold Cup, set perfect fractions and won it well. That was an inspired ride and an inspired bit of training. They'd been jumping, and I know this is correct, so they'd been jumping fences downhill at home to get him used to the downhill fences.
That's rare, isn't it?
It is rare. But they had the time and the attention to detail to go and do that. You know, they were brave enough to put him through those sort of extraordinary tests at home before, just so that he was ready for the day. And he was, and it was superb.
They had one shot at glory, and it came to fruition quite brilliantly for Sarah and Mark Bradstock. Mark, who died at the age of 66 the day before yesterday, and yesterday at Kelso, Nico de Boinville spoke to Gordon Brown.
Nico, like everybody, obviously devastated to hear the news about Mark.
Very sad for all the Bradstock family and everyone involved with the yard. You know, he's an absolute star of a man, and I think he's had so many good horses go through his hands. Maybe not loads of them, but he's had more good horses than a lot of people. So, yeah, he'll be sorely missed.
And, of course, you're responsible for giving him that big win in the Gold Cup with Coney Green. I mean, as a novice, he'd such a great season. You give him his finest hours.
Or rather, Mark and Sarah let me ride him, which was very good of them. They didn't have to. I was only a conditional at the time. And essentially, they got me going in my career.
Yeah. Tell us about him. What was he like to ride for?
Very, very straightforward. Very supportive. Very rarely had a bad word to say. Kept it very, very simple, and for a young jockey coming through, that's all you needed. All their horses jumped incredibly well. They were known for jumping and staying, proper old school national hunt types.
And of course, basically a homebred horse that he had winning the Gold Cup, and a straightforward horse. If I remember right, I think he jumped like a buck and you made all.
He did, he made all, which is very hard to do around the new course, and he kept going all the way to the line, and that's what the Bradstock horses do. You know, they're trained to have stamina and jump as well, and his jumping was exceptional that day. And Mark had incredible horses like Carruthers and King Harold as well. So, yeah, he'll be missed by everyone.
Nice touch by you as well, wearing the black armband today.
Well, you know, it's just, you know, they're in my thoughts, and we're all praying for them.
Thanks, Nico.
Thanks a lot, Gordon. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure. Right,
Nico de Boinville sharing his thoughts and memories of Mark Bradstock with Gordon Brown. That was at Kelso yesterday. Mark Bradstock, the trainer of Carruthers, Coney Gree, Festival winner King Harold, who died at the age of 66 this week. Many, many fond memories. A man who is creating fond memories of his own at the moment is one of our guests this morning, Ben Pauling, and another one for you yesterday, Ben. Personal ambition at Kelso in the Premier Novices Hurdle. Now, is it a measure of the depth of your novice hurdle division that you can go to Kelso and beat all these horses, including one trained by your ex-boss, Nicky Henderson, who had festival aspirations earlier in the season, and this horse hasn't even been talked of for Cheltenham Personal Ambition?
Yeah, no, he's a nice horse. He's quite a mentally backward horse. And
orange and black colours here.
Yeah, Lynn and Angus McLennan have only had horses with us this season, and we've had a fab start for them, and they're very, very easy people to train for. They're very patient, and from the word go, I sort of didn't think this lad had the mental attributes quite yet for Cheltenham or anything like that. He has an ability, has ability to compete, but yeah, we've got a lot of nice novices, and this is another one of them. And we were thrilled to see that, you know, this was a very much a plan from early season, to be honest. So to go up there and get his head across the line in front was great.
You're training for Lynn and Angus McLennan for the first time this season, and you win one of Scotland's biggest biggest races. That, I'm guessing this wasn't an accident.
No, it wasn't. Ironically, they haven't had much luck in the race previously, but you know, they are from up in the north, and to be honest, they're so easy. They run horses wherever you want. There's no pressure to be back up north and like that. But I think it means quite a lot to win one of the good races on Kelso's big card.
Okay, so how far in advance of possible ambition, or personal ambition, I should say, are your Cheltenham novice hurdlers in terms of their street wisdom?
Yeah, they're probably a little bit sharper mentally. You know, we've got the three that probably go to Cheltenham just seem to travel and jump. You know, they went a proper gallop there to the first two yesterday at Kelso. I mean, they went too quick, really. And we absolutely bundled the first two hurdles, and thankfully then Woodsy got into a bit of a rhythm. But if that happens at Cheltenham, you're not getting back into the race. So that's probably why we were where we are with him.
Now, we need to talk about Keelan Woods, who had a mammoth suspension because of serial whip offences. And he only came back earlier this week with victory at Wetherby. And you'd already said in interviews during the course of the week that you felt that he would ride the vast majority of your Cheltenham string. How much faith do you have in him as a rider and as a long-term stable jockey?
Yeah, I mean, Woodsy's been a big part of the team now for a long time. And, you know, he picked up a fairly hefty ban, I don't know, a year ago now, probably. I can't remember the dates. And that was when the rules first came in, and he was done for totting up. And so, as a yard, you know, we had Luca in behind.
Luca Morgan,
who has since retired. And Luke's massively benefited from Keelan's time out of the saddle last season. And with Luca, we had somebody that we knew and trusted implicitly. Mm. And so it sort of all kept ticking along very nicely. And then, unfortunately, Luca's weight got the better of him. And he was a huge part of the yard and remains a big part of the yard because he's doing quite a bit of pre-training for us now. But Ben Jones has come in behind Keelan, and within a month or two of being involved in the yard properly, Woodsy's got another big ban, which has allowed Ben to demonstrate what he is capable of.
Yes, it's all working out quite well in a strange sort of way.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But we can't get away from the fact that, you know, we know Woodsy's very talented. We know he's a proper horseman. But we also know that, and he knows, and he wouldn't mind me saying, that we can't keep getting these lengthy bans.
So he's got to keep his head.
Yeah, and he has worked hard on it with George Baker and various other people, and I really hope he can.
Do you worry with a big festival around the corner when you've got?
I mean, if he gets
blood up and 65,000 people yelling for you.
If he gets a ban before the festival, then it wouldn't be unimaginable, really. But yeah, the festival's going to be a big moment for him because hopefully he's riding horses that have chances, and when your blood's up, that's when the troubles come, you know. But he's a big part of the team. I'm really pleased that he's come back, you know, with a winner at Wetherby, and then obviously he's got the Grade Two there yesterday, and hopefully that just settles everything down. There's a lot of bravado with, you know, jockeys, and you know, it's all easy, it's all this. No, this is the time to settle down and make sure that we don't do anything we don't need to do again, so we can keep the show on the road, because the owners want continuity.
And this is what you were saying earlier, isn't it, about trying to keep your mental state nice and even, even though you've got this kind of highly adrenalised few days ahead of you?
That's it, yeah. It's as big as the occasion is, you're there to get a job done as well. So like, you have to keep yourself level, I suppose, is key.
Let's talk about these novice hurdlers. I did suggest earlier in the week you might be the only person other than Willie Mullins, and maybe Gordon Elliott, who'd have a runner in all three, Supreme, Baring Bingham, Albert Bartlett.
I'm not one for stats, but if you tell me something...
I'm only guessing. I don't know. I don't think Nicky Henderson's got one in every race, has he?
I honestly don't know
off the top of my head anyway. Answers on a postcard. But let's go up in trips. Shall we tell her the name for the Supreme, first of all?
Yeah. He's a horse that I think... he ticks all the boxes in my eyes for a lot of things. The future is very exciting with this fella. He's an embryonic chaser through and through. He possesses an awful lot of natural speed and is incredibly agile with it. So hopefully with a bit of luck with the weather, I mean, I don't know what we're going to start on. It's probably looking increasingly more like a soft rather than good soft. But if he's won on soft, he just couldn't handle that desperately
really deep, yeah,
heavy ground at Aintree. He just didn't go a yard on it. And when he's completed, he's been fairly unextended. So he's an exciting horse for us. The Megsons, who are big supporters of mine. Yeah, it would be great if we could be competitive in the first race of the festival.
Now, Handstands, Harry Cobden was pleasantly surprised at Huntingdon that he did what he did, having ridden in work and felt like he worked like a 105 horse, was his comment on this show last week. But clearly he's a very good horse. Who's going to ride him?
I haven't even discussed it, if I'm honest, with the owners. Ben Jones rode him in his first two novice hurdles, and Ben's been incredibly good for us this season. But I haven't discussed it with Tim yet.
Tim Radford,
yeah. This horse was sort of... Tim only bought him in November, and John Kilbride, Tim's agent, actually said to me, you know, when are we going to know if we've got a Ballymore horse? And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, there's only probably realistically 10 of those a year. How are we going to get this lad to be one? But very, very easily, he sort of went through his novice hurdles, and, yes, he won at Hereford and he won at Newcastle, as he liked against...
You've beaten the same horse there that you beat yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
With personal ambition.
Yeah, and this lad just did it fairly easy, I think. Harry was very complimentary about him and said, honestly, he was sort of asleep throughout the whole race, and I gave him a click and he took off, and that was sort of that. He just idled in front. I think this horse has got an awful lot of ability, and I'm very excited to see what he can do on the Wednesday.
And you've got a runner in the Albert Bartlett as well?
Yeah, the Jukebox Man.
Yeah, who ran so well in the Challo Hurdle.
Yeah, he did. He ran a blinder in the Challo Hurdle. He got beaten in a bumper by Gidley Park.
At Chepstow.
And good form, Johnny.
Good form.
Yeah, it was. But I thought to myself there and then, I thought, wow, this Gidley Park must be something out of the ordinary, because we then went to Fos Lass and won our bumper as he liked. Won his couple of novice hurdles very, very easily, as he should have. And then we chucked him in the Challo, and that was grueling. That was heavy ground. They went a proper honest gallop, look away, thought, you know, he was the handicapper. He was going to try and expose any weaknesses the rest of them had. And it was a ding-dong up the home straight, which got a little bit slower and slower and slower. But he was resolute in his attempts and just failed by a length or so.
Now, I was at Sandown the other day when you introduced a horse called 6 Mile Bridge in the bumper. It looked like quite a good bumper, but anyone who'd looked at the betting realised it was completely one-sided, because clearly everyone who'd ever met you had steamed into this horse. He must have been working the house down before this race.
Yeah, he's just a very, very straightforward horse that goes particularly nicely. Woodsy has actually been his biggest fan since day dot. I think Ben was thrilled to get the opportunity to ride him. But he'll go for the champion bumper, and Woodsy will be back.
It's a big price as well.
Yeah, he is. And he did this on a dirty track wash, which I couldn't believe. I could not get him clean.
Constitution Hill can't do that, can he, on a dirty track wash?
Every horse handles things differently, you know. But I have not been able to get this horse clean all season. And so I thought, we either run or we stop. And Andrew and Jane Megson, said, look, Benny, just do what you think. And so I said, look, we'll roll the dice, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Has he taken it all right, then?
Well, not only is taking it all right, he did a lovely piece of work at Kempton last week, and he got a clean track wash yesterday.
So you've actually just blown the cobwebs out of it.
I'm hoping we've managed to get rid of... If we can get a... I don't think I'll even track wash him again now, because I got a clean one on Friday.
You're running him whatever, aren't you? So that,
well, I think if we got a track wash which was not satisfactory on Friday, we probably wouldn't have, because you have to be careful. But now we've got one, we'll just go with that.
OK, now, I have to ask you about Harper's Brook.
Yeah.
Because he's come into conversation already, because Johnny was upside him when Johnny fell at Sandown on an ex-Chelsea Deo. They're both fancied after a fashion for the various races at the festival. Have you spoken to Harper's Brook this morning to see how he's going to run?
I watched Harper's Brook work yesterday. I was very happy with him.
Look at him, honest as the day is long. Look at those lovely big ears. Whoa!
He's solid.
He needed that though,
yeah,
didn't he?
Yeah, he enjoyed that bump. But look, he's so much ability. He really has. If Harper's wanted to, you know, he could be a graded horse without any trouble whatsoever. And so the standard... Oh, my God.
Needed that as well.
Yeah.
But you don't want to watch this, Johnny, do you?
I don't want to watch this.
No, this is the point.
So Johnny's the white cap here.
I'm hoping Johnny actually stands up here, because it's going to push us up the hill, hopefully. But no, there you go, Johnny boy. But look, he's got loads of ability. The level of the race, the competitive nature of the race won't affect him, actually. I think the quicker they go, the better he'll be.
I would venture to suggest that Godolphin's biggest success this week came via their support and sponsorship of the Thoroughbred Industry Employee Awards, which took place at Ascot Racecourse on Monday evening. And if you missed it, here's what happened.
Welcome to the 20th Thoroughbred Industry Employee Award, sponsored by Godolphin.
Are you quite shocked?
Big time. I honestly cannot describe how I am feeling right now. I could cry. I don't think I'll cry, but I could cry. It's amazing. It shows how much you mean to the yard and what the boss thinks of you, because they don't have a great deal of time to turn around and go, well, you are doing a great job. And this just highlights the fact that they do actually appreciate you, like, the things that you do for them. Unreal, like, to be part of these awards, it's just, I feel very honoured, very privileged, it's amazing.
This is something very special. It is probably the most uplifting and certainly most heartwarming night in the racing calendar, I think.
It has been all about the positives, all about what's brilliant, our industry, the people who make our industry tick.
These are the grassroots, the backbone of our sport.
What a place to celebrate 20 years and in the presence of Her Royal Highness. So we're thrilled.
It's been an amazing day and everyone has been so lovely and welcoming, and I can't believe it. This wee project New Send of Glasgow has got here.
What a fantastic opportunity it is for all trainers, owners, stud farms to get involved and recognise what these fantastic people do.
Employee of the Year 2024 is David Porter Macro.
Biggest award of the evening, the most prestigious award, and it's a double award winner on the night for David Porter Mackerel from Newsles Park Stud. You are the Employee of the Year for 2024. Not just that, the 20th anniversary special as well. There you go, there's the trophy to prove it. Just tell me what that means to you.
I don't think I can tell you what it means to me, to be honest. It means an awful, awful lot. I can't put it into words, to be honest. I don't know what to say.
Do you think this is going to be something that sinks in over time? Not quite yet.
Yeah, it's going to take a while. But it's the culmination of a lot of work on my part, but also a lot of help and support from a lot of other people.
Who's here to support you tonight?
Mostly my wife. Obviously, the biggest support. Also got a couple of friends here tonight, and Julie and the boss and the owners, and you know, everything kind of has to click into place and work to give you the platform to do this. You know, you need the right circumstances to work under, you need the right mentors along the way from beginning to end. It's an awful lot to think about, a lot of people to be thankful for.
We should introduce now as well, here's your prize. It's to be shared as well with the team as well at Newcastle Park. And it's recognition and then some, isn't it? £30,000 as the Employee of the Year, the 20th special. It's no small amount.
No, help on it. Pay for a shopping trip or two.
If it could be a special family holiday, maybe, something like that.
Yeah, you'll have to ask her, but yeah, maybe.
Nowhere near a breeding season.
not before July, eh?
We'll let you go and enjoy the night. David, congratulations on behalf of all of us, the Employee of the Year. David, all yours.
Thank you.
David Porter Mackerel was the last person you heard from there. After the Thoroughbred Industry Employee Awards at Ascot Racecourse on Monday, David was the Employee of the Year. He also took the award for Stud Employee of the Year. Congratulations to him, to all the winners. Now, you saw in there Lauren Semple, the winner of the Thoroughbred Industry Employee Awards Community Award. I'm really pleased to say that Lauren joins me now. Lauren combining her work for Police Scotland with her work for the Scottish Racing Academy. Lauren, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Not at all. And perhaps for those who weren't able to watch the live stream on Monday evening, it'd be great to start by just explaining how your two roles combine quite gloriously, really, to push horse racing into the community.
Yeah, as a sergeant in the community policing in Glasgow, I was really fortunate to start working with the Scottish Racing Academy to provide education and employment opportunities to kids from kind of deprived area that have never seen horses before. So thankfully, the Scottish Racing Academy gave us that opportunity, and the kids have just flourished with it. It's amazing what these horses can do for these kids.
And you gave us some wonderful examples the other day of how you'd seen tangible results in the crime statistics and in the behaviour of young people, quite often from very difficult and challenged backgrounds, because of the work that you do with horses.
Yeah, it was a very sad set of circumstances that came around. There was a murder of a 15-year-old boy, and when we'd done some research, there was no diversionary work for girls of any age available. So that's kind of why we started this project. And one of the big bit was we reduced antisocial behaviour by 85%, which is massive. And the effects these kids have now with their behaviours, it's amazing. But what the horse can do, going from not wanting to touch them within an hour, they're not wanting to leave and want to take the horse home. You know, it's so fantastic.
And Lauren, tell us a little bit more about where you work in your job with Police Scotland, and what your day-to-day policing looks like in the place where you work.
I work in Shettleston Police Office, which is in the East End, which is notorious for being not kind of well received. It's got a high crime rate, high violence rate. And I am based working with the community. I work with the kind of, in the mornings I do the statistics, and then we work with all the housing organisations, the schools, the campus officers, and any other projects that we can do to help try and remove crime, basically.
This award that you won on Monday night, to what extent has this resonated with some of your colleagues?
Oh, it's been amazing. They can't believe it that a project from the East End of Glasgow and Police Scotland got such a prestigious award. It's fantastic. And it's actually, there's loads of them now of like, how can we use projects that are similar, not necessarily through horse racing, but actually the greater good we can do we don't want to criminalise people. We want to try and show, provide the opportunities for diversion. Can we give them another way, a way out of a circle of violence? And this is things that we can be part of and break down the barriers and hopefully have a more positive light for police officers, because unfortunately no one ever sees us in a good sense, that we will never arrive when something's gone wrong.
It is, in every respect, pretty amazing what horses can do. And clearly, horses are having a very positive effect on you as well, Lauren.
Oh, yeah, I've got... You get horses here. I'm a pony club mum, unfortunately, but we take it for granted, honestly, what they do. And it's trying to... I remember having a cry in a stable and you forget how emotionally releasing it can be. So to have them there, they never judge you. And that's a bit for me. They're always supporting you. It doesn't really matter what. You can be anyone from anywhere and they will give you the same response. And that's the big bit for me with horses.
Lauren, congratulations. Thanks so much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you for having me on.
Lauren Semple, who is the Community Award winner at the Godolphin Thoroughbred Industry Employee Awards at Ascot Racecourse on Monday evening. What a woman, what a story. And every year these awards provide the very best snapshot of the industry, Lee. And it struck me, Monday was we'd talk about it a little bit later, was the day of the parliamentary debate. I thought, well, never mind that. All you needed to do was basically live stream the event at Ascot into Westminster Hall. And I think we'd have been in better shape.
And particularly that story there, Nick, because I think what a lot of the MPs were trying to get across in Westminster Hall was how important racing is within so many different communities. And Lauren there provides a wonderful example of how racing increasingly is doing that. I'm a judge on the RCA Showcase Awards, which provide lots of examples of how racecourses are getting out into communities and doing great community work. It's so much more than just about people owning, riding, training horses, betting on horses. There is a big community aspect to horse racing that we shouldn't underplay.
All right, welcome back to the show. Our talking points will be along in just a few moments' time, but one talking point dominated the beginning of the week, and that was before Constitution Hill, of course, and that was the parliamentary debate that took place on Monday and the impact it is likely to have, if any, on the future of horse racing, and indeed the impact it is likely to have on the execution of the Gambling Act. Lee, you were following this pretty closely. You attended Westminster Hall Monday. What were you faced with?
So I was faced with a room that was busier than had been anticipated.
You looked it on the pictures.
Yeah, I mean, the debate was triggered because over 100,000 people signed the petition against affordability checks.
And this petition had been kicked off by Nevin Truesdale, Chief Executive of the Jockey Club.
Who was there on Monday.
Right.
As was Martin Cruddas of the Arena Racing Company. Representatives from the BHA and others from racing as well were in there. And as I said, there were more MPs in there than had been expected. Now, people watching the TV pictures will have seen a few empty seats, but all the MPs who were there seemed to be in agreement that for a petitions committee debate, this was unusually busy and that there was a lot of strength of feeling in there. It went on for all its allotted time, which again is unusual.
Which was how long?
3 hours. So we had 2.5 hours pretty much of MPs voicing their opinions.
Were you still engaged by the end of the 3 hours, or had you lost the will to live?
No, it was actually very interesting, Nick. There was a bit of back and forth. There were interventions from MPs. The vast majority of MPs who spoke in support of the petition's aims, namely that the government thinks again on affordability checks. There was an awful lot of commentary about horse racing, to the frustration of some of those on the other side of the debate who tried to imply that racing was being used to hijack this subject. And then at the end of those 2.5 hours, after we'd heard from people like Philip Davis, Conor McGinn, George Freeman, Lawrence Robertson, who all spoke, I thought, really good sense, trying to explain why they believed that in terms of principle and pragmatism, this was not the right approach. We had responses from first Stephanie Peacock, who is the shadow gambling minister, if you like. And then
upon whom an awful lot of hopes rest in terms of racing's relationship with a potential new government.
Well, more on that point in a second, Nick, is what I think. But then we had Stuart Andrew, the gambling minister, who I have to say I thought was really disappointing, because after 2.5 hours of, say, strong speeches, it felt like the minister basically read out a pre-scripted address and occasionally made a knot of things that had been said in the debate. But it felt for all the world like he'd come there with his line and he was going to give his line regardless of the logic and the common sense that was given to him on the opposite point of view. So I thought he was disappointing, but I thought the debate itself was positive in the sense that it showed the government how much feeling there is on this subject. It showed the government how much feeling there is within the Conservative Party on this subject, because Sirine Duncan-Smith was the only Tory backbencher in there who spoke out in support of what the government is doing. Every other Conservative MP in there was against the government's plans.
Now, a lot of them won't have a seat after the next election.
No.
So you were saying you wanted to come back to horse racing's relationship with potential senior MPs in the next government. How's that going?
It's not going great by the looks of it. So Conor McGinn was one of a handful of Labour MPs. Well, Conor doesn't now sit as a Labour MP, but he was elected as a Labour MP. Labour MPs who were in the room. All of them, apart from Conor McGinn, were pretty much supportive of what the government is planning to do. And it was noticeable that Conor was the only, in inverted commas, Labour MP there who was keen to speak pro-racing and against what the government is planning in affordability checks. It is a concern going forward, because I've written my column about this in the Post tomorrow, and I've suggested that maybe Rishi Sunak is trying to gear us towards a non-conservative government by introducing a non-conservative policy. We are going to have, in all probability, a Labour government. In all probability, a Labour government with a very big majority indeed. And it has to be a worry that the only Labour MP, in inverted commas, there, who was speaking pro-racing enthusiastically and against affordability checks was someone who isn't even standing at the next election. Nobody else was in that room from the Labour Party who was actively pro-racing's case in this. And given how much effort had been made to get MPs into that room, that has to be a worry.
OK. Ben, you're a successful trainer who is firmly on the up and for whom things are going quite well at the moment. Can you see the impact and effect of affordability checks and the headwinds, as racing's administrators like to call them, on your business?
Yeah, I mean, it is... I'm genuinely someone, when it comes to politics and, you know, the noise around various different factors, I try and keep my head down and concentrate on what I do, and that's training racehorses. But this is one of those topics which I'm really starting to pick up on, and I follow everything actually through Lee's reporting, really, and the podcast, keeping up to speed with it. And it is a huge concern for our industry, for me, and other trainers, of how it's going to affect us going forward, because we know full well that gambling is the main source of, you know, revenue into the industry. And I just think there's always a lot of... This is probably a really basic way of looking at it, but this is how I approach most things in life.
Well, it seems to have done you all right.
Is, at the end of the day, there's hard facts that this is not going to, in any way, shape or form, benefit an industry which is the second most viewed sport and a huge, you know, revenue stream to the nation, with the affordability checks. And I'm picking up on the points of, you know, why we're not stopping anyone going to the shop and buying four bottles of wine when they can only afford one. You know, it comes down to bring it back to the bare basics. And are any government really going to impose something that's going to have a huge detrimental effect to one of the biggest sporting leisure time industries in our country and push it forward just regardless, in a funny way, to sort of drive a point which I think will end up just being a few people that have got the beer in their bonnet, and I hope the government will see sense and reverse it. I mean, I'm probably living in happy land here, but I just feel the arguments against affordability checks are becoming so strong and more obvious that I think they'll have to listen.
What has been so frustrating, Nick, is that, and we saw this again on Monday, is that Stuart Andrew continually, or more than once, said that we have no intention to damage horse racing and we'll ensure horse racing does not suffer as a result of this. But that's akin to saying, I'm going to put you in a cage, I'm going to let a crocodile in, promise you it won't hurt you. You know, what they are doing...
It's only a small crocodile.
It's only a small crocodile.
Tiny teeth. File its teeth down.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, what they are doing is already damaging horse racing. So you can say all you want, this isn't going to... We don't want to hurt you. If what you're doing is hurting you, then you are responsible. And as this Tory MP said in that room, how ironic that this Conservative government could be the one... That is deemed responsible for causing huge damage to a massive industry.